Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. We have a tremendous guest this week, someone that I've been hounding like a police dog, trying to get on the OG pod for a couple years now. We always pay homage to the OGs. And when it comes to authors and researchers and reporters and journalists in this space, TJ English is one of the true greats. His book, The Westies, which was put out, you know, dare I say 30, 40 years ago, was one of the first things that I read that really got me into this genre, interested in it, and propelled me towards a career of writing in it. So I've always wanted to get TJ on here and pick his brain. And TJ, thank you so much for.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to be here.
Can we talk a little bit about your process in diving into the Westies and learning about Jimmy Coonan, and talk a little bit about the crossover? I know I've always been fascinated by how Jimmy Coonan was kind of in some ways seduced by the mafia and wanted to tell me, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, kind of started to kind of morph into those guys at the end, to the point where he was maybe kind of alienating some of his own people because he wanted to be hanging around the Gambinos and acting more like an Italian than a Westie.
Right. Okay. Well, two questions there. You first asked me about process.
Yeah.
I was a young kid at the time. The Westies is my first book. I started working on that book when I was 29 or 30 years old. I was working as a freelance journalist and driving a cab at night. And so these things of process, how to go about doing it, I had to make it up as I went along because I'd never done it before. I was a reader of books. And I guess in a way I was kind of a student of books, but now I was having to write one. And, you know, I sold the book Proposal, which was kind of miraculous, and then got the assignment and had to do it. And I've had this idea from the very beginning of doing this that you sink or swim on the sources that you are able to get. And I, from the beginning, wanted to write that story and other ones that I've done as much as possible from the point of view of the criminals living in that world. That's a high challenge to get those sources. You can always find cops and prosecutors who will talk to you.
Yeah.
Finding people in the criminal world to talk to you is not an easy task.
Yep.
And so this was what was the big challenge to me. I, to make a long story short, was able to connect with Mickey Featherstone, who was the number two guy in the gang who had turned state's evidence against the gang and was testifying against them. And I kind of connected with him in the midst of all of that. He was in prison at the time. And he would call me from prison, you know, and this was like pre-cell phone. Mm-hmm. So I had to be ready for that call and have notepad right there by the phone. And you know, when you get that call from prison where they announce that someone's calling you from such and such a facility. And so this began a relationship with him. And I quickly saw that this was the book because I was getting... not only I was getting not only information about crimes from him, I was getting an insight into the whole mentality of the life that he had lived and grown up in and that he was a part of. And I saw that was the real value. To me, the Westies, I hardly even think of it as a book about organized crime. I think of it as a book about a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the relationships within the neighborhood that happened to because of the crime history that existed in that part of the city, and it's sort of been passed on from generation to generation, that this was their inheritance and this was the world they were operating in. And it was high risk.
Hell's Kitchen, right?
High risk. People, a tradition of people getting whacked for all kinds of reasons, a perilous universe to be, to grow up in. And so here it was mostly males, men having to navigate this world. And the relationships were incredibly tight and emotional. The bonding within the gang, these are all kind of extreme states of being, you know. In Hell's Kitchen in the 70s and into the 80s, it was like a wartime situation. And your relationships were based on that kind of brotherhood. What are you willing? Are you going to back me up? I mean, can I count on you? Are you going to be there? And what was so perverse about the Westies is, of course, that they discovered this technique of dismembering bodies, cutting them up and disposing of the bodies. And this is how they got away with it for a number of years. And Jimmy Kunin's philosophy was no corpus delicti, no investigation. This is pre-DNA.
No body, no crime.
Yeah. You can't get away with it in that way anymore. By the way, people rarely, when we talk about, you know, why murder rates are down so drastically in most big cities, that's a big part of it. The
security cameras are everywhere. You can't do anything right
now. Well, DNA evidence. You can't leave a hair behind, yeah, you know. Right. You just can't get away with it like you used to be able to get away with it. I mean, back then, literally, if you made the body disappear, you couldn't really even have an investigation. So there was a practical side to that philosophy. But along with the practical side of that philosophy, there was this brotherhood thing. Like, how far are you willing to go with me? Are you going to be there at my side through the dismemberment of a body? Because this is what we have to do. This is the way we do it. This is the life we've chosen, so to speak. And that dismemberment thing became a bonding thing. So anyway, this is a long-winded answer to your question, but
we love long-winded answers here.
As I got into the story of the Westies through the point of view of this source, this privileged source, I started to see it as a whole. My emotional connection to the material shifted quite a bit. Now, I tried to speak to Jimmy Kunin at the time. I was on good terms with his lawyers, and they explained to me, Jimmy says that if he's not in a position to be fully honest with you, then he doesn't want to do the interview. And I had to respect that. At least he was admitting or saying basically what the real issue was. So to me, the fact of the matter is, as I started to write up this story, Kunin became the antagonist. Featherstone was the protagonist. Kunin becomes the antagonist. And now I'm starting to see Jimmy, I don't want to say the bad guy, because I don't really think in terms of good guys and bad guys, but I started to see Jimmy as the manipulator. So in terms of him being seduced by the Italians in Brooklyn, I don't think he was seduced. I think he was smart enough to realize that the criminal rackets in Hell's Kitchen were drying up, and they alone were not enough to sustain a criminal organization and make money for everybody. So I think Jimmy, who was a bit more savvy than most everyone else in that group, started to think in terms of expansion and partnering for the obvious financial benefits in doing that.
The Italians loved him. I mean, they thought this was the greatest thing in the world that they could.
Well, he gave them access to the West Side and the tradition of the West Side rackets. You know, that was a big thing in New York. It's where the docks are. It's where so much commerce is. Going all the way back to the years of Prohibition, I mean, that's where the warehouses were, where the booze was kept. A long criminal tradition in that part of the city. And most specifically, there was a huge convention center being built there in the 70s, the Jacob Javits Convention Center, which is still there. And that was a huge bounty for organized crime. The way it works in New York is when a massive civic project of that size is being built, it's like a feeding frenzy for the mob to determine who's going to get control of all the different contracts, you know, cement contracts, carpenter contracts, just the who gets the right to set up the food trucks at the construction site, who makes the money off of that. It's a huge criminal bounty. And the Gambino crime family definitely was looking to get in on the ground floor of that project. And on that particular project, he kind of had to go through the Westies to get there because the Westies had a territorial imperative there with that project. So that alliance was born out of economic desire. And I think they liked Coonan because, you know, Jimmy often wore a suit and tie, at least a sports coat. He dressed up. He kind of was like a union official, you know, in that sense. That's how he presented himself. A reputable guy, not a user of drugs, you know, kind of tried to set an example and failed miserably at that because a lot of the Westies were cocaine users, heroin users, alcohol abuse. That in many ways would sowed the seeds of the decline of that gang. Coonan was cut above that in a sense. And so I think he was just smart enough to realize that partnering up with the Italians was the way to go for their own survival.
Was Featherstone a substance abuser?
Yes.
He was a little more on the wild side than Coonan.
He started out way on the wild side. He's a Vietnam vet who came back from the war with a lot of problems, psychological issues. He did a killing like very quickly after coming back from Vietnam. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity. He was put on Thorazine. He was a heroin addict who drank a lot. He started to straighten up. Actually, Coonan was the one that sort of plucked him off the streets and said, I can use this guy. And he kind of gave Mickey a lot of advice along the lines of presentation. You know, how do you present yourself? People are looking at you and drawing opinions about you. And so he became a mentor in a sense. And Featherstone started to settle down in terms of his drug abuse. But yeah, that was Mickey's rep as a wild guy who could go off the handle at the drop of a hat.
And can you talk a little bit about the predecessor to Jimmy Coonan as kind of the boss of Hell's Kitchen, Mickey Spillane?
Yeah, not to be confused with the writer, Mickey
Spillane. Right.
A kind of legendary, they call him the last of the gentleman gangsters. He inherited the criminal rackets in Hell's Kitchen that had been going on at least since the turn of the previous century. And he was married to the sister of the political boss in the neighborhood, the McManus family. He really was a power broker. He was more than a gangster boss, although that's what he was, but he also was just a big power broker in that neighborhood. And he was revered, not only liked, but revered by everyone in the neighborhood. He had a bar called the White House. People refer to him as Kennedy-esque because he kind of represented that, you know, Irish Catholic nobility or royalty. I say everyone revered him except for this new generation of hoodlums that was coming up in the neighborhood in the 70s, Coonan, Featherstone, half dozen other guys who were ambitious, Jimmy in particular. Jimmy was ambitious. He saw a way to take over the leadership of the neighborhood rackets. And one of the biggest impediments to that, of course, was Mickey Spillane. And Mickey Spillane and Coonan had a little mini war in the 60s. The Coonan-Spillane Wars, it was a shooting war. They were taking pot shots at each other for a number of, over an extended period of time. And it got really heated. And you were forced in the neighborhood to kind of take sides with one of those other factions. And it only came to an end in 77 when Spillane was murdered across the river out in Queens. And it was done by a faction of the Gambino family, who was doing it for their own reasons, but they also were doing it as a favor to Jimmy Coonan. It's kind of what paved the way, laid the groundwork for the relationship between Coonan and the Italians, that they would take on that task. So Mickey Spillane was moved aside, and Coonan filled the vacuum. And this was a scary period for anyone who lived in that neighborhood, because it had kind of been established by then that this group of guys was making bodies disappear. An older gangster who had been part of Spillane's crew, named Eddie Kaminsky, had trained to be a butcher in prison.
The butcher.
Yeah, and he brought this skill back to the neighborhood. And he kind of was playing both sides during the Coonan-Spillane wars. And he eventually goes with Coonan. And he's the one that teaches Coonan the dismemberment process. And so everyone in the neighborhood had become aware. I mean, it had always been a neighborhood where killings happened, and people had to try to figure out who or what was behind it. But all of a sudden now bodies were disappearing. Your loved ones, your uncle, your brother, all of a sudden doesn't come home one night, and weeks go by and he still hasn't come home. That serves the value of not only killing, getting rid of that person, but it instills terror and fear in the community. And this is what Hell's Kitchen had to deal with in the late 1970s and early 1980s.
Did Jimmy Coonan and the Westies have to be politically savvy in terms of their relationship? I know they were very close to the Gambino, but the Gambinos and Castellano and Gotti, like those guys. But you know, the Genovese were, you know, they're called the West Side, and Chen Gigante at that point was kind of coming into his own. So did he have to play both sides of that fence?
That whole situation was pretty perilous. I mean, the faction of the Genovese crime family in East Harlem, Fat Tony Salerno and that crew, were systematically murdering partners of Mickey Spillane's, because they were vying for control of the Jacob Javits Center and other things, but mostly the Jacob Javits Center. And so those killings were happening. And they hired a freelance hitman by the name of Joseph Mad Dog Sullivan.
Yeah, Mad Dog Sullivan.
Who I got to know pretty well before he died a few years ago. I visited him in prison a few times, and he was a character, and he filled me in on a lot of stuff. Most of it was after I wrote the book Westies. He reached out to me after I wrote the Westies and another book I wrote called Paddywhack, where he features rather prominently in those books.
I forgot about Paddywhack.
Yeah.
Ah, God, that's another great one too. I forgot that you wrote that.
He reached out to me and he was like, "How do you know all this about me?" And I was concerned, because I had actually gotten my hands on an unpublished memoir that he had written. And I used some of that, and I thought, well, he's not going to be happy with that. But he was like, "Nah, that's okay." He said, "At least you got it accurate." He said, "Why don't you come and see me, and we'll talk some more about it." So I struck up a relationship and would go to see him in prison. He was in a prison. His last name's Joe Sullivan. He was in a prison in Sullivan County, New York, called the Sullivan County Correctional Institute. I said, "Joe, they're so worried that you were going to try to escape," because among other things, Joe Sullivan's the only guy who ever escaped from Attica prison.
Right.
Did it on his own. Incredible feat. I said, they were so concerned that you were going to try to escape. They put you in a prison where the county's named after you and the prison's named after you, just so you feel at home and you wouldn't feel the need.
It's hard to be low key and stealth when the building that you're staying in and the city you're staying in has your name.
So Joe Sullivan filled me in on what was going on between the Genovese family and the West Side Irish and the Gambinos. It was all heating up in the 70s. And, you know, alliances were being formed. It's such a treacherous world, you know. It's a weird world to be forming alliances with somebody and hugging them and kissing them on the cheek and all the things you do in the criminal world to reassure a partner that you're loyal and they can trust you, when you gotta know deep down inside that this is probably the guy who's going to try to kill you down the road, that this is probably the guy who's going to turn against you. I mean, it's such a treacherous world. I don't know how they convince themselves that they can trust people.
Can you talk a little bit about the women in the world, the wives? I know they started to play a role as you know, legal problems started to mount.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating because Jimmy Coonan's wife, Edna, and Mickey Featherstone's wife, Sissy Featherstone, were kind of mirror images of the men. And so they undertook a relationship that had a lot of the same dynamics that that the men had. And where that comes into play is Jimmy and Mickey go off to prison somewhere around 1980 on a counterfeiting charge. They beat a murder rap that would have put them away for life, but they do go away on a counterfeit charge, and they're going to be gone for about 4 or 5 years. And so Edna, who was tough, who I encountered a couple times during the Westies trial, because she was out on bail, even though she was one of the defendants, she was out on bail. So she was in the elevators and hallways at the time of the trial. And she was a tough broad, man. She was old school. She was a hard, hard woman. I remember talking to her attorney and saying, you know, how do you go about representing her? And he said, well, the first thing I did was try to get her to go to Eve Arden's or what's one of those
finishing schools,
finishing things where they show a woman how to put on makeup and how to walk, right, present herself. Yeah, Edna was tough. So she took over collections of monies, you know, because those guys would make the rounds in the neighborhood and pick up envelopes of money from all the local businesses. That was the nuts and bolts of how that neighborhood gang functioned and operated and prospered. And so she did take over aspects of that. And she was tough. In fact, she alienated the Featherstones to the point where Mickey decided he wanted out. And this really begins the process that would bring the gang down, because as Mickey started to voice his dissatisfaction with things and his desire to get out of the gang. And by now, Coonan wasn't even living in Hell's Kitchen anymore. Neither was Mickey, for that matter. They were living in New Jersey. They still used the neighborhood as their base of operation. But so Mickey had his followers. In fact, many of the guys, you know, when it came to hanging out and drinking and having fun, most of the gang members preferred Featherstone over Coonan. Coonan was kind of a killjoy, you know. It was kind of like, here comes Dad. Mm-hmm. Hide the beer, you know, hide the coke for sure. Right. So that began the end of the gang.
Two more questions, and then we'll get you out of here and get you on your day, get you on your way to finish your day. Yeah. And we appreciate the time you've taken to come and share your perspective and insight and knowledge. So as the group was coming to a close and Castellano is assassinated and John Gotti takes power, there's a guy named Bosco.
I'm going to cut you off right there because I think the whole Bosco narrative
is not true,
is a fabrication.
Okay. Tell us that, please.
By the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York to make a case against Bosco.
Okay.
They came up with this narrative that Bosco had inherited the Westies and taken over the Westies. It's just not true. There's no evidence that that's true at all. First of all, the gang was taken out in the trial in 88, the Westies trial. There were 8 or 9 defendants, all the main people in the gang. By then, the gang had either was taken down in prosecution or they'd become informants. Mickey Featherstone, Billy Beattie, older guy named Tony Lucich. These were all important members of that organization who'd become informants. So the gang was systematically wiped out, not only criminally, prosecutorially, but the neighborhood had changed to the point where it didn't sustain old school Jimmy Cagney era gangsters like that anymore. It just that was like a throwback to another time. So the culture that sustained the group was gone. So there was nothing for Bosco to inherit.
Okay.
And he had no standing in Hell's Kitchen. Nobody really, many people kind of knew he was a partner of Coonan's, and he would make the rounds with Coonan, and a lot of the union guys who were under the control of the Westies were familiar with Bosco because he was part of that world. But Bosco was never a street leader of an organization of any kind in Hell's Kitchen. So when Jimmy was taken out, Jimmy Coonan was taken out. They wanted to take down Bosco. They had lots of reasons to want to take down Bosco. He was a criminal who was involved in organized crime. He didn't have an organization with him. He was just a freelance operator, very high-level, powerful guy. A lot of people liked him. He certainly had quite a legendary history, you know, as a Chechenian freedom fighter and all that stuff. But no, so the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District wanted to make a case against Bosco. They figured they were going to use Gravano as a witness against him because Bosco and Coonan did have meetings face-to-face with John Gotti, and Sammy the Bull Gravano was at some of those. And so they were going to take down Bosco in a racketeering indictment by claiming that he took over as leader of the Westies. I don't buy it. I never bought it. I think it's a fabrication and a fiction to make that case. And it's illuminating to me because it makes me think, how often do prosecutors do this? You know, how often do they take what they have and just kind of like finesse it and massage it to create a bigger case or a broader case or a case that strays into the areas where they think they have the strongest case to make, which is kind of what they did with Bosco.
I will defer to you. If TJ is saying that this is a false narrative, I'm going to always side with TJ. I had never spoken specifically about that with TJ before, so I'm glad he was able to shed light on that, and it's going to give us a little segue to finish up. The reason I'm kind of bringing us into modern day times here, the only reason I bring up Bosco is because we know that Bosco Radonchik had his own protege, a right-hand man driver named, well, they call him Mike the Serb, Mileta Milanchik, I believe is his real name. And I'm of the opinion, and if you don't feel comfortable, if you don't feel well-versed on this, just tell me and we don't have to go there. But I'm of the opinion that right now, this guy, Mike the Serb, who was tied to Bosco, he could be one of the most powerful criminals in the world. His influence when it comes to narcotics, politics, it's geopolitical. Mm-hmm. Do you have any comment on him? And he's allegedly a part of the Gambino organization now, is very close to Lorenzo Menino, who's the boss of the Gambinos now. And I just know that he traces some of his roots back to Bosco and that stuff. Do you have any
No, I don't know anything about it.
Okay, well, that was quick. Yeah. And then just kind of finishing off here, my last question. And maybe I'm going to throw something out that I heard in addition to the question and then have you answer the question and address what I heard, and then we're done. I've heard that if you're talking about the Westies in 2020s. I mean, there's really not a group there in any way, shape, or form or semblance of what it was at one point. But I've heard from people that I trust, good sources on both sides of the law, that there are some relatives of the original Westies that, while not being a formal organization, have some role in modern day criminal activity in New York City.
I've heard this from many different sources. I suspect that that's true, but it's the furthest thing you can imagine from organized crime. Right. It's basically nieces and nephews or relatives of some of the big names, Coonans, McElroys, Comiskeys, who are trading on those names, you know, to sell cocaine in a bar or to try to extort money out of somebody. I don't doubt that there's some version of that going on. I mean, there's still a lot of bars in that neighborhood. There's probably cocaine circulating in some of those bars. So you ask yourself, who controls that? I mean, that is a neighborhood where it's always had this mentality where somebody controls that. If you're going to have cocaine circulating in various working class bars in the neighborhood, it's probably coming from a single source who has say over, you know, who's allowed to sell coke on a block or in an establishment and that sort of thing. So yeah, I don't doubt that still exists, and that there's people who are the offspring of the Westies looking to parlay those associations into making a few bucks for themselves. But it's not the Westies or any right. semblance of the Westies.
And then final question, what happens with Jimmy Coonan? I know he's in his 70s. He's fighting trying to get out. I'm not sure if he has an out date. If he does, it's another 5-10 years from now.
Well, he doesn't have an out date yet, but he's in the zone where he's eligible for parole. So he goes before the parole board every 2 years.
Okay.
He went recently before the parole board and was turned down, I believe. But 2 years from now, he goes before the parole board again. So he keeps making his case.
Does he ever get out, in your opinion?
I have no idea. I mean, that depends completely and totally on the parole board and the decision they want to make. It's a tough one because we're talking about someone who was directly involved in the most gruesome manner thinkable in a lot of murders, different murders, disposal of bodies. I mean, Jimmy Coonan was, to my mind, about as Machiavellian and extreme a gangster as you can think of. He had many good qualities too. You know, I'm sure his family members love him and will tell you why. But in the criminal world, he was a terror, kind of the worst of the worst. And so my guess is he's got a spotless criminal record, and becomes his argument for parole. That he's not the same man, that he's a changed man, and that he's old and maybe not well in terms of health, and that he's not a threat to anybody, that the world in which he circulated as a mob boss is long gone. There's nothing for him out there as a criminal to go back into that life. But you got to weigh all that against what a hair trigger temper this guy had. I mean, some of the killings were just him going off and losing control of his emotional self. And if he's that kind of person in any way, shape or form, then you're taking a risk by, you know, giving him a get out of jail card. So they're having to weigh that, and they're going to make a decision based on how they view it. And there's absolutely no way I can predict how they'll, what will happen with that, I mean, they have let guys out.
Oh yeah, I know. I cover it. They've let people out that you would never think could ever see the light of day, and they get out. And then there's other guys where you're like, it's interesting that they're still in, but they're still in. I mean, the Gemini twins, Roy DeMeo's guys,
who
the government thinks have, you know, possibly killed, you know, 70, 80 people.
Yeah.
They both walked out in the last year.
Yeah.
They did 30 years.
It does happen.
35 years.
Yeah.
Tell everyone where they can find you, TJ, and tell everyone the release date for The Last Kilo.
I've got a website, tj-english.com. You can Gmail. I mean, you can Google my name, and a lot of information will come up about me and how to access books. I have a new one coming out called The Last Kilo, Willie Falcone, and the Willie Falcone story, and about the cocaine era. It is, I think, used the word definitive. Thanks.
Very comprehensive.
It attempts to be kind of the most complete and final word on the cocaine era in Miami, but also branching all around the United States. So that book comes out December 3rd. I'll be out promoting that book. I'll be doing a little mini book tour. So please look for information on that book and pick up a copy as soon as you can.
Last question. State of Grace. Great movie, good movie, or average movie?
Oh God, I'm the most biased person to ask that question.
Right. For people that might not know, it's kind of slightly based on the Westies. Sean Penn, Ed Harris, Gary Oldman, Robin Wright. That's where Sean Penn met Robin Wright. And Sean Penn plays a former member or former buddy of Irish gangsters in Hell's Kitchen that goes to become a cop in Boston and comes back to infiltrate his old friends. Yeah. And there's some analogous situations.
Yeah. There's no way I can like that movie.
Okay. All right. I got you.
Because of my bias, the book and the movie and that movie came out roughly the same time. And, so I know the real story of the Westie, so I'm not going to accept any
I respect that.
Bogus version of the story.
It's your version of the Irishman for me.
And I have all kinds of issues with the portrayals of the different characters and who they're supposed to represent and who they're supposed to be. And the movie just feels fake to me. But I'll say this, they shot it in Hell's Kitchen. It kind of looks great. And I know there's a lot of people who love that movie. And in fact, there's a lot of people who come up to me and think that that movie was based on
the Westies.
The Westies. So it's kind of the bane of my existence.
I didn't mean to bring up a source.
I have to answer for that movie all the time. And, you know, whatever. It is what it is. But no, I'm definitely not a fan of that movie.
It got released, I believe, the same week or the same 2 weeks that Goodfellas came out, so it got totally lost.
It was a bomb when it came out. I mean, commercially, critically, it just disappeared within a few weeks.
I didn't know about that movie until I was probably in my 30s. And I was like, wait, there's a movie with Sean Penn where he plays an undercover
guy? Yeah, and the reason the reason it became the bane of my existence is it kind of killed... You know, the Westies was optioned immediately, like even before it was published. And that movie killed the Westies as a film project for many, many years. I mean, people would say, wait a minute, didn't they just make a movie about Irish gangsters in Hell's Kitchen? And it bombed. Why would we make another one? Luckily, Hollywood has a short attention span. Yes. So eventually that movie was completely and totally forgotten.
Well, thank you, TJ. I didn't mean to hit a sore spot there at the end, but I think I love the insight you gave us. I mean, it's great insight.
Yeah.
So I'm glad we got three or four.
Whatever. People can like the movie. No hard feelings if you like the movie.
I just said great, good, average, and I didn't even give you a horrible. You put it at number four.
Yeah. I put it in a special category.
Yeah. That's what I feel about some of the stuff we don't go down that rabbit hole, but thank you so much, TJ. This was awesome. Really. You're always welcome back. The next book when you get it ready and it's, you got galleys going around, let me see it. And then we'll bring it back on, and anything you put out, I'm going to devour it. I would suggest all of my audience, anybody that's into true crime writing and reporting, go grab yourself some TJ English content. You will be better served for it. Thank you, TJ.
Thank you, man.
Very much. Enjoy the rest of the week. Thank you out there. Thank Benny behind the glass. Please like, share, subscribe, spread the word about OG Pod, uncovering the underworld, one city, one region, one country at a time. I'm Scott Bernstein. Come on.